Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Mm. Hello Fresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.
Flexibility is great. That's why there's yoga. Flexibility for your insurance coverage is great too. That's why there's United Healthcare Insurance Plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, United Healthcare Insurance Plans offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage for medical, vision, dental, and more. One of these plans may be right for you if you're, say, between jobs, coming off your parents' plan, turning a side hustle into a full hustle, or even missed open enrollment. Want more flexibility? Find out more about United Healthcare Insurance Plans at uh1.com.
You think about the person in your life when you started believing you more than anyone else. They're the ones that make the sacrifices. When I walk out, my old man's next to me. They're not just looking at you, they're looking at what made you. I want them talking about our fucking game. I want them talking about us. All right, enjoy your lunch.
Welcome, listeners, to The Extra Inch. My name's Windy, and I'm joined by my sidekick and best friend, Bardi. Hello, Bardi.
Hola, Windy.
And our tactics guy, and a man who has found out, rather bizarrely, that he has the same musical taste as our fourth-choice goalkeeper. It's Nathan Clark. Hello, Nathan.
That's me. For people who don't know, Alfie Whiteman's been doing some DJ sets on the side, some live-stream DJ sets, and they're really, really good. They're absolutely banging.
It is really interesting that we've produced two youth players who are, I don't know, if they weren't in the same group, but they could only be a couple of years apart, who are like both really arty, both little hipster art boys. Is there something in that, I wonder?
You're throwing
and I'm talking about
twist.
Alfie Whiteman. Yeah, Will Miller, who is now, yeah, exactly, a producer, which is cool. Yeah, and Alfie seems like a very nice fellow.
What does he?
I suspect he might be getting released in the summer.
What does he mix? What's his Wheels of Steel? What are they churning out?
What are you asking? What's on his set? Wheels of Steel? Is that
show my age? Yeah. Does he not mix vinyl? He's not traditionalist. I don't know what does he play?
Because it's live streamed, right? It's all digital, so it's all queued up on the virtual stack.
On the virtual web, on the world wide web. What is it though? What's his thing?
It's like avant garde stuff, but also like lush psycho pop sort of stuff, you know? Roomy.
Okay. Roomy. Nice.
He likes, was it the Cocteau Twins he was playing on one of his radio shows?
That's right.
Yeah, they're great. Yeah, good stuff, man. I want to give a few thank yous to our various listeners who've emailed us. So Mario Machi, Joseph, Benjamin Wenton, Stephen Doyle Page, Alec Dekrinsky. That Alex always getting these shouts out. He's prolific with his emails. Fred Clandy, Jason Kennedy, Kevin Griffin, Ben Elliott, Jesse King, Palab Ghosh, who is approximately 4 out of 10 on the Windy fame scale, so doing pretty well. Connor McDougall, Matt Hooton, Austin Garner, Danny Harris, and Tony McLaughlin. Thank you all very, very much indeed for getting in touch. We really appreciate it. And John Bartz had this to say regarding Nathan's comments from the previous episode. While I can't say he's wrong, I will contend that there are many great things about the United States. It seems that the overgeneralization of the US is that it consists of New York, Florida, California, and Texas, basically two coasts and some empty parts in the middle, all inhabited by idiots. While there are many idiots here, there are also amazing spaces and places that I would highly encourage travelers to the US to check out. Our national parks, for example. I live in Montana and take a lot of pride in being a Montanan, or Montanan? Montanan, I'm going to go with. The tradition of conservation and preserving natural areas while supporting access to these areas is a point of particular pride here, essentially public lands that belong to everyone. In addition to the plethora of open space, there are cowboys, those who think they're a cowboy, 7 sovereign Native American tribal communities, as well as interesting small towns and cities. If mountains and rivers aren't your thing, it may not be for you.
I'd like to go on the record as being pro mountains and rivers.
Hmm. Can I join you there? I had a... My Spurs-free weekend consisted of essentially running and walking in the Chiltern Hills near where I live, and it was very beautiful and very invigorating.
Oh, yeah.
I'm glad you two are apologising to America, because this is the kind of place I was talking about last week. Get like one of those houses out in the countryside and just don't do anything. But after a little bit of further research, it's a bit too cold. I want to be able to like hop from like nice climate to nice climate. The minus 30 stuff with like knee deep snow, that's just not for me. I'm not going to do that. So I won't be moving to Idaho or Montana.
That is very fair. I also really enjoy visiting the US. I had the most amazing trip to Chicago last year. I thoroughly recommend the place. Just incredible architecture, amazing food, amazing craft beer scene, if that's your vibe. Yeah, Chicago is the place to go. Amazing. Really fantastic place.
That was with your best friend, yeah?
That was with my actual best friend, yeah.
Every time that knife stings.
Don't dredge this up again, Vardy. I mean, we're literally going to... People will be crying into their phones right now, mortified about what's happened between us. We had this email from Frank Johansson, who is making the very expensive trip over from Norway with his 6-year-old son. And may I say, RIP to Frank's father. He said the cost for Sunday to Tuesday being the following: plane, £500, hotel, £500, tickets, £400, plus expenses, bringing my son to Hamleys, plus food and drinks for us, so close to £2,000, I reckon. And on that topic, a question for you guys addressed to the self-proclaimed proper fans out there. During 90 minutes, especially since the Wembley days and until now, there are long periods of quiet during games. When we sing, it usually roars, especially the Arsenal game last April I attended being the best experience. But noise from the home fans per 90 minutes must be one of the lowest in the league by now. I'm interested to hear your thoughts. Thanks. I thought this was a really interesting comment and discussion topic about the new stadium. I think most people would probably recognise Spurs' away fans as some of the noisiest in the league. I think when you watch us play away game on television, the away fans always come across loud and clear, and they make a right old racket even when we're losing, and that is to be commended. Our home fans, however... the decibel levels seem to have dropped since we moved to the new stadium. What do you think, Bardi, as a season ticket holder?
I mean, first of all, I never thought I'd live long enough to hear a Norwegian complain about the price of coming to England. That's amazing. It's like £20 a pint in Norway. But yeah, I can understand if you're bringing your kid over from Norway and all of that to go watch Spurs is expensive. I think in terms of the sound and the atmosphere, with Spurs, it's always been a natural ebb and flow. And as the game kind of peaks in excitement, the sound goes up, and then there are natural bits where it drops down. I think what Spurs have always been keen, especially as a fan base, is not to generate an artificial level of noise, which is like a constant drum or a constant chanting, which just happens no matter what is going on, which you kind of get with German teams. And I've also seen it abroad as well. So with Spurs especially, we need the players to give something back, and if the players are at it and the team are at it, then the fans are generally at it as well. But if it's kind of passive or we're in a bad mood, which just happens to Spurs fans a lot, then it will be quiet. Yeah, that's just the truth. We don't generate an artificial amount of noise. We don't have anything like those idiots Ashburton Army or the Holmesdale Fanatics that just create a constant droning of noise that just blends into the background.
Yeah, definitely agree that like because of the acoustics of the new stadium, it's like when it's quiet, it's quiet, and when it's loud, it's loud. But like there were definitely some quiet seasons in our last decade at the old White Hart Lane, right?
Yeah.
But I think going back to your point, Buddy, a couple of weeks ago about not being anyone near anyone you know as a season ticket holder, like I remembered again in the old White Hart Lane, my dad had a season ticket. I would take that season ticket every now and then, to the extent that I formed a relationship with the people who sat around my dad's ticket, you know. And I think that perhaps the lack of knowing people nearby is going to be affecting not how loud it gets at its loudest, but maybe that low level drone in between the quiet parts, perhaps.
Yeah, that's fair. It's so easy now to sell your ticket and make good money from selling your ticket that people do that a lot, and it does have an impact on the faces and the kind of regular noisemakers.
But the truth is that there is a direct correlation between price of ticket and loudness of fan.
Yeah, 100%.
Absolutely. And I'm wondering if there's something about the style of football that plays into this as well. I'm thinking aloud here, so this is not a fully formed point, but having a lot of the ball and kind of dominating possession whilst not creating chance after chance, which is a lot of what we've seen this season, could lead to a bit of complacency amongst the crowd, sort of feeling like you don't necessarily need to encourage the team that much because they've got the ball, they've got control. And then getting frustrated when we're not doing anything with the ball, or not regularly doing enough, as the perception might be, with the ball, to the extent that your frustration comes out in like a moan and a groan rather than a song. Could that be something to do with this?
Maybe, but I also just think that like good football is more conducive to singing than the bad football that we've had a lot of recently.
Mm, yeah, fair. So we got this from Brody Bradford Tom, which is a fantastic name. Just a quick one in response to a topic on previous week's pod about getting a hold-up striker in the summer. Don't we technically have a hold-up winger in Kulusevski? I feel like his role in the team is essentially to have the ball fired into him, use his body to win fouls or control it, and then play in ahead of him. He rarely, if ever, would receive the ball over the top. Not sure if this is reliable going forward, as it's unlikely we get someone else in that profile if he comes out of a team, but would Kulusevski work with a hold-up striker in the team? I feel him and a hold-up striker would essentially mitigate all of the space we create by enticing in the press, playing from deep and build up. Any thoughts?
Would he? No, because like we've used, like, if you go back to the Brighton game, everything good comes from hold up play, whether that's through Richarlison or Kulusevski. So we mixed it up there. I'm not too worried about that. But also, we're not going to change our profile of number nines anytime soon anyway, so you don't have to worry about that either.
Yeah, and I think the point I was making, maybe I over-egged it a little bit in relation to the kind of Son Richarlison comparison, but because the thing is, the striker in Angeball doesn't have many touches generally in open play. That it's not like we're firing pass after pass into the forward. We're asking them to make more runs in behind, but they definitely do come short for the ball occasionally. And my point was simply that when doing that, when coming towards the ball, I felt Richarlison's touch was more reliable than Son's. Kulusevski, in my opinion, has a more reliable first touch when the ball's fired into him than either of them. Yeah. And I think he does that really effectively. And I think if he were playing in the central role more, he would be very, very reliable for that. But also, he'd often be receiving the ball like with it facing the other way if he were playing the central role. So the key, I think, is to have players who are flexible, who are multifaceted, who can come and receive the ball to feet, or take a touch, or play a first-time pass. And yeah, like, coaching is going to help for sure. But personally, I think it's like an aspect of Son's game that you just have to accept is never going to improve that much. Like, he's just not good at receiving the ball to feet, as we saw a lot during Antonio Conte's tenure as manager. So go on, Vardy.
Yeah, I'm a bit down on Kulusevski at the moment. I get the idea of a hold up winger, but I'm just a bit down on him, and I just think we need a better wide man, which I guess we're going to talk about dribbly wingers later, but I guess we need a better wide man than him. But as a hold-up winger, like Lukaku back in his younger days would quite often play wide, and he caused a lot of fullbacks problems. Then as he got older, he kind of fell out with Solskjaer, especially at United, who wanted to do it again. But I can see the value of having that kind of wide, almost wide target man is something difficult and hard to play against. But yeah, I'm not sure. I'm not sure about Kulusevski. He's a great player, but I'm just not sure about him right now in our formation working wide for Postecoglou.
So let's do dribbly wingers now. And instantly I saw Nathan's interest peaked. This is his subject, and we got a couple of suggestions. So Tom says, I know there have been many names thrown about for a dribbly winger. I haven't heard Kvicha Kvaratskhelia.
You can call whether him Kavara. Kavara's fine.
Is it? Yeah, is that what people shorten it to? By. Okay, because I literally had to write that out phonetically to make sure I had a choice.
I should have come in earlier.
Tom says, whether or not we can actually afford him, who knows, would he be a fit stylistically? And Sean Prendergast says, you guys have mentioned candidates for a dribbly winger, which I would tend to agree is maybe our biggest need at the moment. I know players like Nico Williams or Nusa seem like ideal candidates, but I was just curious if you guys, especially Nathan, had any thoughts on Pedro Gonçalves from Sporting. He's a player more in the mould of a Bernardo Silva, but someone I think who could provide more attacking output or incisive passing than our current wingers, as well as provide cover for James Maddison in midfield. So thank you very much to Sean, who mentions he's from Canada. And Tom, what do you think of those suggestions, Nathan?
So Kavara is going to cost an insane amount of money. He obviously, like, Napoli aren't in the same position they were in before, where they were, you know, winning Serie A and they've changed coach and things are down. They're probably going to sell Osimhen in the next window, although I thought that last summer, to be fair. Kavara is probably either staying at Napoli or going to, like, Real Madrid, basically, I feel like. I suppose they're going to sign Mbappe. Anyway, I feel like he's...
Maybe Liverpool?
Yeah, maybe. He's very good, but he's going to cost more than he is good, basically. Same with Mittimer. Now he's signed a new contract, right? Those are the top two guys, but both of them aren't financially good business for each reason. And then, Gonçalves. I think we kind of have a player like him in Kulusevski, even in Maddison, as you rightly point out. Like, we could play Maddison wide, but then we'd lose him in the middle. It's just like, I think for this role, I want a real out-and-out specialist, not someone who's like, oh, maybe they could play that role and then also cover in the central. I mean, to be fair, I have included Ray and Cherky, who's kind of a little bit that way, to be fair, in my list. But I think for the most part, I want a natural out-and-out wide player who probably has some level of explosivity, even though Nusa and Kavara aren't actually that rapid. They just have incredible skillful play. I think, for that reason, I'm leaning away from Gonçalves and other similar players. I want someone who's, like, you know, 90th percentile dribbler.
And when you say other similar players, would you include Eze in that?
Yeah, maybe. And he is one who, like, very contrary to what I just said, he might be enough of a winger to be a winger and also offer that depth in the central area. But then again, we have Kulusevski who can play in the central area, and maybe Eze would you know, free him up to play those minutes more. We have Lo Celso, who remains in the squads, whether you like it or not, for the time being. So that's not a desperate need, in my opinion. Eze's good. Eze's really good.
I've liked Eze since I first saw him play for Wickham on loan. My best friend, mentioned earlier by Bardi, is a Wickham season ticket holder and says that Eze is the best player he's ever seen play for Wickham. At that time, he was mainly playing as a kind of number eight. And then obviously when he broke into the Palace team, it was as a wide player.
But he plays both
signed
now,
by Palace, I should say. Yeah, exactly. He can play 8-10, he can play wide. And I think I do value versatility really highly when it comes to thinking about summer transfers. I think having a flexible squad is really going to be important. And last summer, I think it was on one of our live pods we did talking about transfers, I think I said no to Eze because I didn't think he met the criteria for the dribbly winger. And now I've seen Ange Ball in action and have watched Eze more closely in relation to, like, the role. I've done a 360 and I want Eze. I think Eze would be in my top three signings for the summer. I think he is a brilliant player and also just like pre-peak, about to explode, like really could elevate us.
He's 25, so I reckon that's about early peak. He is, in fact, about 90th percentile for his dribbles. 92nd percentile for take-ons attempted, 92nd for successful take-ons. He signed a new contract in November, so I probably not too likely.
I went to the West Ham Stadium on Friday night to watch Colombia versus Spain. And Nathan's friend, Nico Williams, came onto the pitch. They introduced him. Spain had all the ball for 45 minutes. Didn't do anything with it. Typical Spain. And then in the second half, Colombia put on James Rodriguez. Remember him? And even though he can't move anymore, can't high press, he changed the game. And him and Luis Diaz tore Spain apart for like 10 minutes. And Colombia got a goal. So they did what any team should do. And they sat back and parked the bus. So Spain brought on Nico Williams versus a low block. And first of all, this is the first time I've seen him live. I'm not sure if you guys have seen him in the flesh, but the guy is big. He's really tall. And he's quick, obviously, and he is very good. So he got the ball for the first five or six times he got the ball. They doubled up on him, and you could hear there was apprehension in the crowd because you could see this guy moves different from everyone else that Spain had thrown at them previously. And there was wild scenes of celebration as the two defenders managed to dispossess him. But as the game went on, his performance got better and better, and all of a sudden he started getting past his man with ease. And he's definitely something else. He's definitely something that we could do with. I don't think we have a player like him. And he's tall, but he's got a nice touch. He can move quick. He could take players on. He was very good. And even though Spain didn't win the game because Spain did Spain things, yeah, he's a very good player. But Luis Diaz was next level, man. Luis Diaz was scared the living crap out of Spain. I know you're not a huge fan of his, Windy, but he was good. So by Luis Diaz or by Nathan's friend, Nico.
Was Diaz up against Porro?
Yeah, he was up against Porro, but he did all right against Porro. Porro did good. First half, Porro kept him under control, okay, and he was all right, but it was towards the second half that it changed. I'm not sure if they took Porro off because it was the other side, but yeah, he struggled. No, they didn't take Porro off. Yeah. There we go. Diaz ruined Porro.
Yeah, there you go. I mean, I scouted Porro prior to assigning him, and Bardi has now scouted Williams. The extra inch getting it done.
And talking about good scouting, Vicario started last night for Italy. There we go. They gave him a go over Donnarumma, and it seemed to be the kind of general consensus. It could just be Milan fans who are still grumpy with him, that everybody was pretty happy. He kept a clean sheet on Thursday night. Donnarumma managed to give away a really cheap goal with his feet. So perhaps with Vicario, it's impossible that he will start as number one, but he's definitely putting the pressure on Donnarumma for that number one spot.
God, that must be the first time Donnarumma hasn't started for Italy in Christ knows how long.
It's almost like he's got something in his contract for him to break the caps record, because he does always start.
Did Udogie start at left back?
He played the first game, but not the second.
Yeah, Di Marco played the second game. I think it's very much for Italy at the moment. Di Marco and Destiny are two.
It's not a bad pair of left back, as you mentioned before, right?
It's pretty good. It's a shame we just don't have any forwards.
There's some suggestion that we had an agreement with Italy that he would only play one out of two matches, which, okay, if that is true, I approve.
Yeah. I mean, Italy
makes a lot of sense.
They made the crazy decision to fly to America for these two games, which wasn't great. Mm.
Elliot Robbins says, I just wanted to hear your opinions on two topics that have been on my mind recently. The first being whether Daniel Levy deserves credit or maybe even praise for keeping well within the bounds of financial fair play rules. He seems to get lots of criticism for his management of the club, but currently the Spurs' financial position seems to be extremely strong, setting us in good stead going forward. The second question is, does Pat Matasar become homegrown after his contributions this season, potentially giving Big Ange some more transfer wiggle room in preparation for next season? I feel like we spoke about Levy fairly recently, and I think we all agreed that he deserves a huge amount of credit for kind of keeping us on the straight and narrow in relation to financial fair play. Not just that, I mean, if you look at all the data, it suggests that we now have the biggest potential spending power in relation to staying within financial fair play rules, which we probably won't utilise. We probably won't spend as much as we possibly can. But the fact that we can do that, I think, speaks volumes to his planning and his meticulous accounting. And I think he deserves plenty of credit and praise for that. personally.
Push back a little bit on saying that we won't utilize it. I mean, like, if we have, like, I don't know, 700 million we can spend, we're not going to spend 700 million. That's insane. But I think the January window that we just had is an example of us utilizing the circumstances. Like, we were essentially the only Premier League club who were in a position to actually spend some money. And I think other situations like that are going to arise. And then also, like, you know, potentially buying other Premier League clubs' academy graduates as well. Similar things like that. That's still utilizing that advantage. Mm. I mean, yeah, I had a lot of criticism for Daniel Levy all last season, or most of last season, and also recently on ticket issues. But in terms of the long term, and in terms of financial fair play, Levy is one of very, very few chairmen in the entirety of the English game and the majority of the European game who is not either cheating in financial doping or recklessly destroying the finances of his club, right? Almost all the other clubs in elite football are overspending. And if they're succeeding, they're cheating. If they're failing, they're ruining their club, right? I do have criticisms for Daniel Levy, but he's still one of the best of a terrible, terrible bunch.
There was a word you used in this. I watched this incredible film on the weekend, American Fiction. I'm not sure if you guys have seen it. It's on Amazon Prime for free if you want to watch it. But there was a line in it where it goes, "Potential is what people see when they think what's in front of them isn't good enough." And yes, Spurs have potential to do something good, but they haven't at the moment, and we need to do better. And it's all well and good, Daniel Levy, getting us into this position where, hey, we're doing great, no financial fair play penalties or anything else like that. But I think it's time for us now to start seeing the benefit of this potential and everything, that the amount of money that we spend, the amount of money we're charged, and the stadium, etc. I think we need to see something, especially this window, to give Postecoglou what he needs.
I do think we're going to see a huge, huge turnover this summer. I think we're going to shed loads of players, and I think we'll see a lot come in, especially if we qualify for the Champions League. But because we'll be hopefully recouping a fair bit of cash, I don't think we're going to proportionately, I don't think the sums that we're going to lay out are going to be proportionately huge. I don't think we're going to eat into that kind of credit in the bank we've created with the FFP. Which is a good thing, because it means there's more capacity for future transfer windows. But yeah, I definitely think there'll be plenty of spending. On the second question that Elliot submitted about Pat Matasar, we did utilise this ridiculous loophole where we essentially registered him as a Spurs player before we loaned him back to his previous club, meaning that he will qualify as a homegrown player in the Premier League from next year, which is somewhat helpful, I think.
Oh, yeah.
I mean, it makes a lot of sense. Remember, for the first half of this season, we got ourselves into a bit of a bother with the homegrown squad rules. And it was one of the reasons why we were so critical of the signing of Manuel Solomon, because we felt that he was an inferior player taking up a non-homegrown squad space.
Which forced our hand to Brennan Johnson.
Indeed. And some would say forced us to pay more than the market said he was worth. So this kind of planning is really helpful, for sure. And I also think we should be utilising that kind of planning when we're thinking about potential transfers in the summer. I've mentioned Eze already as a favourite of mine. Obviously, homegrown. Kyle Walker-Peters, versatile, can cover both left and right, can play inside, so the inverted role suits him, is homegrown, and it's also club trained, so double whammy there. And then Alfie Doughty playing really well for Luton. Some question marks about his physicality, I think.
Okay.
But really effective on both flanks. Again, qualifies as homegrown. Yeah, I think these are the types of things we should be taking into consideration.
So we spoke about left backs a little bit last week. I've now started looking at left backs, maybe potentially spurred on a little by that conversation. So you mentioned Ait Nouri, and I was like, oh, okay, yeah, I've heard good things about him. I'll check him out. He's incredible. He's really outstanding. He actually might be too good. I suspect that if we're looking for him, other clubs will be looking to offer him first choice. Like Liverpool will be looking for their long-term Robertson replacement in the future, right? So for him to come and be second choice to a young player might actually be too tough. a question asker.
Would he definitely be second choice?
Yeah.
Could we not have two first choices?
Sure. You call him up and try to sell him on that. and end your every sentence with mate. Last week, a listener asked about Hartman at finals. I got confused and was thinking about their right back, who is second choice sometimes to Gertruda, but Hartman plays left back. And yeah, I really like him. He looks really good. He's on the list. Doughty, I started looking at some of his Premier League data and minutes and didn't really see him as the right profile. I just, before recording, started looking to his Championship season, and I think there might be more there for me to look at, so I need to look at him more there. I like Kadioglu at Fenerbahce. He plays both sides. He's right-footed, but he plays mainly left. He's a former winger. I quite like Bradley Locco at Brest. He doesn't have the goals or assists that we might be wanting, but he really has the ball-carrying aspect that Udogie obviously offers, and pretty good defensively. Parisi at Fiorentina. Again, maybe not quite as physical as we might be looking for, but otherwise really nice on the ball. And some more to look at there. I'll move on to right backs in the next couple of weeks as well. But I think that talking about having several transfers in, so I think that we need a winger, right? We need a dribbler, a 1v1 specialist, right? That's highest priority in my opinion. I think we still need another centre-back, especially a left-footed centre-back, having watched the Fulham game. And also just improving our general depth at centre-back. It seems that the club wants to prioritise a number 8 in midfield, potentially benching Saar and bringing in more goals from midfield. I think there's an argument to be made that that's not our most pressing profile, but I'm happy to go along with the club's idea that Bentancur is the backup number 6 and therefore we're okay there for the time being. And then I think, yeah, at least one backup fullback, potentially two. So that's, 4 or 5 first 11-ish quality transfers. That's quite a big ask. And then maybe also we could do with a backup goalkeeper and like a young number 6, potentially. It's a lot.
It's a lot, but I think it's doable.
That is way too much.
Yes, that is
way too much. Especially a backup goalkeeper. If Spurs signed a backup goalkeeper of that kind of profile, I'd be truly, truly stunned, because we've always just relied on old men who could just about catch to get us through.
Who used to be able to catch quite well, yeah.
Yeah, or just young, good-looking men who can't catch and kung fu kick forwards, yeah. Right, so before we get to the ad, here's a bit of a question for you. England's miserable friendly performance versus Brazil didn't feature a Spurs player, but Maddison was in the squad. So let's play a little game of higher or lower. You'll be taking it in turns to guess how many Spurs players were in the England squad for each tournament by saying higher or lower. In the case where it's the same, I'll be nice. If you said higher, I'll take that as correct. So we'll start with Windy, as he's old, and hopefully we'll manage to survive one round. Okay, Windy. At the 2002 World Cup, Spurs had one player in the squad, Teddy Sheringham. The next Euros at Euro 2004, did we have a higher number or a lower number?
I'm going to assume higher.
Yes, we got through one round. Correct. We had two players in the 2004 squad, and that was Ledley King and Robinson. If you want to try and guess who they were as well, I'll do that. So, Nathan, we had two players in the 2004 squad. In 2006, did we have higher or lower number?
See, I do sort of vaguely remember following England in 2006, and like, I'm not convinced. I would have guessed a fairly low number, but just on sort of the odds, just on statistics, it seems sensible to say higher because we're starting from a base of 2, but I don't think it's much more than 2.
You're correct. It was higher. And I haven't done these. I've just gone pure historical. So there's no me trying to play mind games here. Going higher or lower each time. But that's correct. We had 4 players, Robinson, okay. Genus, who remembers that, Carrick, wow, and Lennon. In 2008, famously, England didn't qualify for the Euros. So in 2010, did we have higher or lower that number, Windy?
It's got to be lower, surely, than 4.
Surely doesn't count as a definite answer. Is it higher
yeah,
or lower?
Yeah, we'll go lower. We'll go lower.
No, you're incorrect. In 2010, we had 5 players go to the World Cup.
Wow.
There was King, Defoe, Crouchy, Lennon, and Michael Dawson. Who would have expected that? To take the win, Nathan, in 2012, did we have higher or lower numbers for the Euros than 5?
I'm trying to remember the 2012 squad in my head. Lower.
It was correct. Nathan wins. It was only Parker and Defoe went to the Euros. That famously, Redknapp was supposed to be managing, and I think it was Roy took us there. Well, I did a lot of preparation for that. We managed to get through three rounds, so congratulations, Nathan. You've taken the W.
And then higher after that.
No, it would have been lower. Zero. 2014, not one Spurs player went to the World Cup. And then the reason why I had to put in the caveat, if it was the same, I'd take it, because we had 2016 and 2018, we took five players each time to those tournaments. Because we had, you know, the English core.
Yeah, that's when we had Mason and Townsend in the English squad at one point.
Yeah, they didn't go to a tournament. So in 2016, there was Walker, Rose, Dyer, Kane, Dele, and then in 18 it was Trippier instead of Walker that went there.
I'm remembering an England friendly maybe in sort of 2015 or so, where we had like eight players in the first 11.
I think it was against Italy. I think Townsend scored a welding. There's a really nice photo, I think, of Mason, Townsend, yeah, and maybe Kane as well, all celebrating together.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
If you're a long-time listener, you might know that I've been drinking AG1 for quite some time now. It's part of my routine. It keeps me focused. My morning shake of AG1, a dash of lemon, and a couple of droplets of vitamin D. A lot of people ask me, "Oi, Bardi, this AG1 stuff, does it work?" I'm here to tell you my honest opinion. It's my trusted supplement. It's what I reach to every day, and it makes me feel like I'm making the correct nutritional decisions as it increases my intake of vitamins, minerals, and antioxidants. It's not going to turn me into an Olympic runner or a scientist, but it gives me that feeling that I'm making good decisions in a world that is run by people making bad decisions. And I find it quite comforting to drink my green stuff every day. It wouldn't turn Højbjerg into Pirlo or me into Kipchoge, but it helps me make one better decision every day. Go make better decisions, mate. Go and have your AG1 before your lunch, ideally 10 minutes or so before, or even better, on an empty stomach first thing in the morning. Drink AG1.
If there's one product we had to recommend to elevate your health, it's AG1, and that's why we partnered with them for so long. So if you want to take ownership of your health, start with AG1. Try AG1 and get a free one-year supply of vitamin D3 plus K2 and 5 free AG1 travel packs with your first purchase exclusively at drinkag1.com/extra inch. That's drinkag1.com/extra inch. Check it out. So Norman Pride says, "How did you all meet and decide to make a podcast? I need the lore." So here's how I remember things. You might need to correct me. My memory is notoriously terrible. Bardi and I first met in a pub. I can't remember exactly when I first laid eyes on him, but I'd been on the Fighting Cock podcast for a little while. And I think Bardi came to like some drinks that the Fighting Cock had and had been writing articles for the website. And we met and we got on really well. We became part of the core group that communicated a lot. And there came a point where we decided we wanted to do some sort of standalone podcasts talking more about tactics and football in a bit more depth. And I'd been regularly retweeting this little known Twitter account, Talking Tottenham Tactics, where some guy in his bedroom had been making these really kind of rough cut tactical videos with voiceovers. I really liked them. I really liked what I saw, and would retweet everyone I saw, basically. And I DM'd Talking Tottenham Tactics and said, hey, why don't you come on the podcast? I think that's how it happened. Does that sound about right?
Yeah, I started messaging you with my stuff and you liked it and we were talking a bit. And then I remember we found out we were in the same block at Wembley for a couple of Champions League games. And so
that's right.
And so
I met you and your dad.
Yeah, yeah. And we started chatting at halftime at games. But maybe was that before or was that after? I'm trying to work out the timing. Remember. Maybe that was after we'd started.
Probably all happening around the same time, to be fair.
But yeah, you decided you wanted to, we were just a spin-off of the Fight and Cock. It was gonna be like a rare thing every now and then. Originally, Wendy, I was only gonna be on every other episode. I was gonna be a regular guest.
I wonder what we intended the other episode
just
to be.
Just a
like.
Rotating cast, right?
Yeah. We recorded the first one in a broom cupboard at a place called Audio Boom, was it? Maybe.
Yeah.
It was the hottest.
Yeah.
It was. Oh, it was like it was about the size of a one person sauna that some people would put in their bedroom. It was tiny.
And then we went from there to some rubbing knees.
And then we went from there to some nice studios. We had some really nice studios, and then we realized that Nathan was a whiz at editing and that we could do this via the internet, and that's kind of that helped us become a bit more regular.
That was the key thing, I think. That Audio Boom experience was awful, because they were working with some really big podcasts, like a lot of celebrities, and so I imagine that when these three little dweebs turned up to record their silly little football podcast, they just thought, what is going on here? And I just felt like they treated us with disdain. I felt like they were perfectly pleasant to our faces, but I just felt slightly looked down upon. Anyway, we were very fortunate that Kayvon, who did a lot of work with the Fighting Cock, let us use his studio a couple of times, and his studio space was incredible. It was really a really nice experience. But like Bardi says, realizing, I think it was during the pandemic, really, that we could just do this remotely, and people didn't care that much about the audio drop off. It was a game changer, and it meant that we had the regularity of doing this on a weekly basis, which whenever someone says to me, do you have any advice about starting a podcast? I'll always say, like, if it's an episodic thing rather than a small series, the key to podcasting is regularity. Like, making sure your listeners have something roughly the same time every week, I think, is critical. Because people have an expectation, and when we don't release the pod now, we're getting messages, we're getting emails, we're getting tweets saying, where's the pod? Where's the pod? Need my fix. So it's really important, I think, to people, to listeners. Yeah, so that's how it all came about. And the rest is history, as they say. This is actually the 40th episode this season alone. Like, that's crazy, isn't it?
But there's no beef with the Fighting Cock. There's always comments somewhere on Discord that what happened? Did we have a fight with them? No, we didn't have a fight with them. I was just stolen away by Windy's charms.
And they were, in fact, it was the opposite. They were very supportive of us doing our own thing and kind of going it alone. It wasn't like a decision to separate that either party took. It was more like, no, you've got something here. Why don't you give it a crack? And it took me a while to have the confidence to launch a separate podcast feed, and even more the confidence to launch a Patreon, which you guys were like pushing me on for a while before we finally decided to do it. That felt like a big step.
We'd been talking about doing Patreon for quite a while, and I think we're all a bit sort of nervous about it, and sort of not just nervous, but like self-conscious about the audacity of it, right? And then I was doing the podcast, but also doing freelance stuff, industry side in football. And I had this job lined up working for an agent, and I essentially started the job as is super typical in football, like unpaid first to see how I got on with it, and then it fell through, which was like, you know, awful and illegal for sure, but again also pretty standard. Think about how many times we've had, you know, Paratici starting the job before his contract begins, for example. And I was at this point, I was beginning to work this job. It was hard work. I wasn't being paid for it. I bought a laptop with money I hadn't yet earned. And then the agent just went cold on me. And I was like, right, let's just do this Patreon thing. And now I'm really, really glad that job fell through, because this is much, much, much better. I'm so proud of what we do.
Yeah, I mean, it's genuinely been transformative for all of us. But like you say, especially for you, Nathan, because Bardi and I have day jobs outside of this. This is your job. Yeah. You work in football in a different way to a lot of people who work in football. And to be honest, you're probably getting paid more than you would if you were working for a club, right?
I don't know. Pay might be sort of similar, but the work itself, the hours, oh my goodness. My friends who work in football, the hours they work are absurd, and they're all burnt out and sick of it. And yeah, it's awful, basically.
Yeah.
Yeah, I'm so happy with what I do.
People really are exploited in football, and actually in the world of sports podcasting, people get exploited as well. Like, how many times do I get invited to go onto podcasts with no offer of remuneration? And I used to go on all kinds of pods thinking, oh, you know, it's good for me because I get to spread the word of the extra inch. And I took a decision like relatively recently to only do that for pods that like I have a genuine affection for. Like, I don't just give up my time now for free, because people should be paid to be guests on things. We pay all of our guests, or at least we offer to pay them. Some of them ask to donate it to charity instead. But it's, I think it's really important that we pay our guests, because we're using their expertise. We value their expertise, and it's really important that they are recognized for that.
I still get people message me about jobs that come up in football, like, oh, you should apply for this. I don't want to apply for it. I've done my time working in this job. I never went full time. I didn't do that much. I don't have, you know, really cool things to put in my bio. I did a little bit of work industry side, and I don't have much intention of going back.
Yeah, and rightly so. You're not allowed to go anywhere, Nathan.
Can't afford my release clause, right?
Exactly. Adamalist says, what is each host's favourite type of goal? And I think this comes about because Tyler Adams scored an absolute thunder bastard for the US. I don't know if you've seen it. And I made a comment in the Discord, like, I don't normally enjoy a player just twatting it in from distance, like with very little pressure on the ball. However, I really appreciate the fact that he did that in a final. It was a fantastically pure, clean strike in a final. And it was really impressive. But what's your favourite type of goal, Bardi?
I could see why people like that Tyler Adams goal. We're talking about the one he scored against Mexico. Yeah, he hasn't been smacking him more than that. It's all right. I do like a thunder bastard, but I think that's too far. It becomes speculative. So for me, it needs to be within a certain kind of area where there's a lot of skill and thought gone into it, rather than just I'm going to hit it. And I like the ball to slowly to rise, to keep rising. So its trajectory never stops. So either hit it low and then it keeps going up and up and up, and it just goes ting in off the crossbar. Those are the beautiful ones. But it has to be from maybe 20 yards out. It has to be constantly rising, and I want to get the impression that if the net wasn't there, it was going to murder someone. That's what I want to hear. Like, I want to feel that brutality of hitting it. Because we spent so much time watching Bale, and then after that watching Robin and Messi, I'm really kind of against the cutting in on the left and curling into the top corner. I'm so tired of that. It's such a FIFA goal as well that I'm just bored of those. I'm also really bored of cutbacks. Even no matter how much kind of beautiful work has gone into it, a cutback is just like, yeah, that's boring. So I want to see.
We're gonna score so many cutbacks next season, buddy. It's gonna be cutbacks every game.
It's so boring. It's just like, oh, wow, well done. Oh, wait, look, here, there he goes. Overlap, cut it back. I want people to get the ball and whack it. And I want to hear that ball get slapped into the net. That's what I want.
But not from inside right to left. You don't like that?
No. I like it when I think... I will always remember Landon Donovan scored a goal at the South Africa World Cup, and he hit that ball so hard, and he was only maybe 6-7 yards out, that he nearly killed Samir Handanovic. And that's what I want from my strikes, that there's a risk that it could take the goalkeeper's head off. So yeah, I like a good old whack.
Nathan, any preference?
Yeah, I it's interesting, right? Because not so much nowadays, because the game has changed. The nerds have won. But I spent a long time defending the value of measuring expected goals, the value of counting tackles, etc., of being a stats guy, even though I'm tactics first and stats second, right? A lot of the conversation was about like making football boring by summing it down to its numbers, making it a spreadsheet and formulaic. And I always push back against that. But before I was into XG, I used to love Gareth Bale smashing the ball from 30 yards out. And now, quite likely because of an expected goals orientated mindset, when Tyler Adams smashes it in from 30 yards out, doesn't move me that much anymore. And I think that probably is a shame. And I think that probably is a legitimate criticism of analytics, that I go, well, sure, that was good, but like the setup wasn't repeatable, so it's not a legitimate outperformance of the opposition, right? And I know how stupid, I know how cynical, and I know how unpoetic that is, but I don't really go in for solo efforts generally. I love a good team goal. I love a quick combination, multiple passes, several players involved, one touch football. That's what I like.
Instead of a cutback, I'll let a cutback be acceptable as a golazo, but it has to be a cutback for a header or someone comes flying in as a diving header. Spain scored one against Italy in the 2012 final, and they worked it beautifully, doing all your ticky-tacky stuff down the side, but then they crossed it in and there was a diving header. Bosh. I'll accept that as a good cutback goal.
I think Thunder Bastards have a time and a place. And I think that the time and the place is like they're settling an important or an even game. It's as a fan of the team that they're scored by, like Danny Rose in his Premier League debut, that goal felt really massive at the time. Even though it's not my favourite type of goal, I loved it. Wanyama, that felt amazing. Yeah. It felt incredible. Like, again, it's not my favourite type, but in that moment, it felt really important. They definitely have a time and a place. Like Nathan, I do enjoy a good team goal. I like movement. I like one and two touch football. I like the feeling that everything leading up to the goal has to happen exactly that way for the ball to end up in the back of a net. And also, I love a dinked finish. I love a chip. I love like lifting the ball off the ground to beat the goalkeeper. And Dele was famous for his dinked finishes and scored many goals that I really enjoyed. I don't think you see enough chipped finishes.
Because you know why? The beauty of the chip finish is there is a moment where we're all waiting and looking. And it's that time slows down. So when Dele's most famous chip one, obviously, is the one he did at the Emirates. And there's the moment where the ball leaves his boot. And when you're watching it in real time, whether or not you're in the stadium or at home, it seems like an eternity before you know where that ball is going to drop. And Son did one this year against Burnley away where he dinked it. And it's the same there, that you, in your head, you're thinking someone's going to get to that. It can be got to, but they can't. But it's just, yeah, the way that a beautiful Panenka is so nice as well. I agree with you on the Wanyama one, and I agree with you on the Danny Rose, because I like my Thunder Bastards to be hit by somebody who knows what they're doing, not just they've just swung their foot and hit it. So Huddleston, for example, was the master at these. He scored all kinds of beautiful goals from just whacking it, but that was his character. That was the kind of player he was. So I accept those from him. But yeah, Danny Rose's one, even though it's beautiful and it's, you know, poetic, it's not, yeah, that's not really my kind of goal.
Yeah, Huddleston's striking technique of both feet are just so pure, so good to watch. The other Premier League player that I remember who scored a lot of beautiful Thunder Bastards was Michael Essien. He used to hit a fantastic ball.
Hitzlsperger at Aston Villa would absolutely welly them in. Gerrard has got a back catalogue of goals that he's just smacked in as well. So there are certain players out there who just got that kind of beautiful technique, and the way they hit it is so nice. But it's expected because it's in their playbook. It's not just they've swung their foot at it like Tyler Adams. I don't even think Tyler Adams has ever scored a goal before he hit that one. Yeah.
I don't mind an Eriksen distance goal when he just tucks them. He just keeps them on the ground and just threads them through. Mm. And it's as if he's finishing from 8 yards out, but he's actually doing it from outside the box, you know? A subtle, just a efficient path to the bottom corner finish. Mixing those up in there, you know?
Nice.
But I think I was talking to somebody on Discord about Kane and Son, how they've kind of ruined us for finishing, because they've got two elite finishers, both very different. Kane is far more mechanical, methodical, whereas Son has got a little bit more flourish. That we've arrived at a point as Spurs fans where we've become numb to good finishing because that's all we've seen for the last 10, 12 years from these two. So it's almost like we need to take a break we have that now with Richarlison, who's very far from being a clinical finisher. But we have definitely been spoiled by those two guys who were just brilliant, but they didn't perhaps always score the most beautiful kind of aesthetically pleasing finishes, but even though they were great.
Nice. So we're going to go back to fullbacks briefly. So we had quite a long conversation about incoming transfers earlier, but we didn't talk about outgoing fullbacks. So firstly, thank you to Hardy Kimbrough, who had asked about Walker Peters, and we spoke about him. But Will Mizutani says, what do you guys think about the depth options at fullback? I'm okay with Royale, but is the only other option Davis? He's been dependable as a centre-back, but I'm not particularly thrilled at seeing him in possession as an inverted fullback if that particular scenario arrives. I remember last season at Celtic, Postecoglou used Rio Hatate as a right-back when they had injuries to the position, and I seem to recall that he played well there. Do you guys see any of the current midfielders as a suitable rotation option in the inverted fullback role? I'm thinking specifically about Lo Celso and Skip, who are both bound to lose minutes once players get healthy. So this was sent a little while ago. But I think the point still stands. We're talking about signing one or two fullbacks this summer. What does that mean for you in regards to Royale and Davis?
Yeah. So, just first of all, on Hatate, I think since this question has been asked, I mentioned this, but I went and watched Hatate's fullback minutes and was very unimpressed with him defensively. I think, yeah, we need a new backup right back in the summer, and Royale can go. I think we also should be looking at a backup left back and a backup left centre back. And I think that with that much movement happening on the left side of the pitch, I wouldn't hate keeping Davies at least until next January, just in case one of those transfers doesn't go well, one of those players doesn't hit the ground running, or we don't even get it done. So I think I'd probably keep Davies 6 more months at least, while we look to bed in a couple of younger players as backups in those roles. But I think Royale can go.
Bardi, how about you? You've been up and down on Davis over the years.
The thing about Davis, he's a nice guy who always does well. You know, there hasn't been a formation that he's looked seriously out of his depth. He's just done what he's done. He's Ben Davies, he's Mr. Steady. He's been here so long now, and he's played in a variety of positions and been asked to do a variety of things. And he's always done reasonably okay, which is kind of why I don't mind seeing him stay around for a little bit longer. But definitely Royale needs to be sold. I think we'll probably make some decent money for him. I don't think anybody's going to drop 20, 25 million on Davies. So let's keep him. I'm playing Ben Davies to be future Spurs manager one day. I'd really like to see that.
Yeah, I definitely see a role for Davis at the club in the future. He's a very studious, interesting guy who is a really good communicator as well. And I certainly see him as a coach or maybe even a sporting director going forward. That said, he is 31 next month. And I think he's got 4 or 5 more years of maybe not Premier League football, but decent level football ahead of him. He's had many seasons where he hasn't played a great deal. He hasn't played the whole season. And I think that probably means he can go on a bit longer than other players of a similar age. And so I do think we should sell Davis. I'm open, I'm sort of agnostic as to whether it happens like in the summer, in January or the following summer, but I think we should improve on him this summer anyway. I'd be really disappointed if we started next season with Emerson Royale still in the squad, to be honest. I think he's a really bad fit. I think he's a good player, but in the wrong system. And it's time for him to go. And like you say, we'll get some very good money for him because he is a good player. And he's a really affable guy who kind of fits into the squad well, which stands him in good stead for his next move. And so for me, like, sell both, but like, agree with Nathan, maybe stagger the Davis one. If we get an offer this summer, though, I'm very open to him going earlier. It feels brutal because, like Bardi says, he's been at the club for such a long time and he's been Mr. Dependable, like, not always first choice, but never once made noises about that. Just come in, done his job. When he's coming to the team, it's been fine. Had a couple of seasons where he was really good under Pochettino, but other than that, has just generally been a kind of 6 or 7 out of 10 player consistently, and you need those players in the squad.
Yeah, I mean, like, a couple of the players that I'm looking at, they compare somewhat similar to like a 23-year-old Ben Davies, and if I could bring a 23-year-old Ben Davies into the squad with, okay, a touch more athleticism or a touch more height, probably would do. Mm.
Yeah, I can't believe he's... I can't believe he's just 31. That's amazing. He's like, he's been here so long. Just doesn't age.
And in terms of central midfielders playing fullback, I don't think this is a terrible idea generally. I think because the inverted fullback role receives the ball in midfield, like there's a lot of overlap between the skill sets. And what we've seen in the under 18s is Leo Black, who actually scored for England under 18s today. He is a former midfielder who now plays inverted right back for the under 18s. And I think that is a really good idea. His skill set suits it. And he's learning the role now from a young age, hopefully with a view to becoming first team inverted right back, which would be lovely. It is harder for existing midfielders to suddenly become right back. So Skip or Lo Celso, for example, suddenly becoming fullbacks. On the defensive side, like, they'd be absolutely fine in possession, no doubt about that. They'd be really, I'd say, net positives in possession. But defensively, like, learning how to position yourself, learning how to play an offside would take quite a bit of coaching. That's not to say they couldn't do it, but I think it would be easier at this stage to sell them both and just buy a competent, well-trained fullback and turn them into an inverted fullback, personally. Especially someone with the kind of overall technical skills like some of the players Nathan mentioned earlier. To end the pod, we had this from Teddy Forsher, who says, I haven't heard much, if any, discussion about Richarlison's decision to start and to continue to see a therapist for his off-the-pitch and on-the-pitch mental health. He's been open about it, especially of late. So Richarlison says, I think the mental aspect is so important for a player. I have a psychologist and she's been helping me. I ask the players to open up to this possibility of having a therapist because it's so important. Once they start taking sessions, they'll understand it really helps on the pitch. And I think this is something I spoke about with Alex Stoyle in the bonus episode about sports psychology, but we haven't really touched on it a great deal on the pod, and we should have done, to be honest. So I apologise that we haven't until now. I do think Richarlison is such a leader in numerous ways. He does a lot of good work off the pitch, but this, his openness and his willingness to examine himself and his previous beliefs and be open to change is really impressive. And he seems to have been encouraged by his teammates to do so as well. I think Emerson Royale has had some sort of impact here. He basically says that in the place he comes from in Brazil, it's a rural community. It's everyone knows everyone. And the idea of going to see a therapist is just so far from reality. And he's grown up with that. He's grown up with that expectation that you just don't have a therapist. It's what, I don't know, bougie people in LA do or whatever. And the fact that he has, A, sort of looked at himself and realized that, no, I do need to change something. And B, been so vocal and open about talking about that, who he used to be, who he is now, and the benefits of psychotherapy, I think is so impressive. And I really admire him for that. And it's got to be said, we have seen the improvements in Richarlison's play since his groin surgery and also his starting to see a therapist. Anything either of you wanted to say about this?
It's really good. It's really it's it's funny because I just I've spoken several times in this podcast about like how great it is, or tweeted about it. And I really believe that. And I think it's great that he's speaking about it. And also it occurs to me that like, for the first time in my life, I could probably afford a therapist. And it's something I thought about a few times. And it's something I've spoken to my wife about because she sees a therapist. And I don't have any reason not to. And yet I haven't done it. And I don't feel a great desire to when I feel some awkwardness around it. And I'm not someone who has a hard time opening up because I'm literally doing that right now on this podcast that goes out to thousands of people, right? But I guess I'm trying to say that like I get that taking that step is hard because right now I'm like, I guess I think right now I'm in a pretty good place and therefore I don't need it. And I know that that is kind of a silly thing because actually being in a good place can be helpful for keeping yourself in a good place, for example, right? But I get it. And like I get it along the lines of gender, right? I think that my gender and my relationship with my masculinity, it makes it hard for me to actively go and seek it out because then I will sit there in front of the therapist maybe and go, yeah, I don't know what we're here for. I don't know what to talk about.
I can't imagine you being like that in the therapy.
No, I know, but it's like, yeah, I don't know. Because I don't have like there's nothing specific going on for me, bad. And so I think I would need the excuse. I think I need the excuse of I'm struggling with a particular thing. I'm going through a bad thing. This thing is bothering me. Because I'm so for it in theory, but I'm also saying it's tough in practice to take that step. That's what I'm experiencing right now.
I think your mental health. So there's like your body and how you exercise your body is extremely important to your health, but your mental health is just totally connected to it. That's the muscle that is pretty much in charge, or it is in charge of everything else. So exercising that in the form of therapy, speaking to people is really important. And if that's, it's great that it helps Rishalis, and it's great that he's spoken about it. And I hope more people you don't have to wait for something to go wrong to go and talk to somebody. Maybe it doesn't have to be a psychiatrist if you haven't got the money or the means to get to someone, but even just opening up and talking to someone you trust, there can be stuff done. There's benefit there. There's plenty of helplines out there, Calm, I guess Samaritans perhaps if you're in a real crisis, but there are ways out there, web chats and stuff like that, where you can talk to people for free and just help you kind of get stuff off your mind if that's what you need.
My physiotherapist has done a hell of a lot of good for me physically and mentally, right? So it's like you said, it's all the same thing really.
Yeah
definitely is. I relate to what you said, Nathan, and like the only time I've had therapy was when I was at a crisis point, like in my early 20s. I'd come out of a really toxic relationship and had developed this really severe social anxiety, and essentially seeing a therapist fixed me.
Hey, you're never socially anxious at all, like, are you, mate?
Exactly. Like it's like such a reductive way of seeing it. And the thing is, like, that was what I needed at the time, but what I should have done is just carried on seeing a therapist. The problem is it was a very specific, it was CBT, yeah, which is what the NHS hands out. I actually paid privately, besides the point, but the NHS does offer up CBT as the first option. CBT is a very specific form of therapy which stops like negative thought patterns spiraling, and that helped for me in the situation I was in. But so my wife is a psychotherapist. She has some views that CBT just isn't right for everyone and every situation, and because it doesn't like get to the root cause, it doesn't attempt to get to the root cause. That's not what it does. That's not what it tries to do. So whilst it fixed me, and I'm giving the air quotes again, like the stuff that was causing that social anxiety to come up for me is probably still there. It's probably just that I've stopped like the thoughts that bring it to the surface. And I think like you, I'm very open and I talk about my feelings a lot with friends and family and now my wife. And so I kind of feel as though I'm
making it at home.
I'm getting some like DIY therapy. But like the second I feel down, like, or like I'm struggling with something, I'm stuck on something, I'm 100% going to a therapist. I think it is absolutely the right step. And I should probably just, like you, bite the bullet and start now while things are good, that would probably be the smart thing to do. But there's a cultural thing, isn't there? It feels like somehow you're somehow a waste of time or money or whatever, when actually it's so important to keep on top of these things.
Well, I'm on the waiting list to be consulted for ADHD, so presumably they'll give me ADHD specific therapy when, you know, in about 10 years.
They should do. Like, that would be the holistic way of dealing with that, but you'll probably just get put on Ritalin and told to go away and try it.
I mean, I'd take that right now too.
You have been listening to The Extra Inch with me, Windy, my sidekick and best friend Barney, and our tactics guy Nathan Clark. If you like this, there's plenty more at patreon.com/theextrainch. Production is by Nathan A. Clark. Our logo, artwork and website are designed by Creighton Miller. Our music is by David Lindmer. You can find him on Instagram at David Lindmer. Do check him out, he's great. Follow us on Twitter and Facebook at The Extra Inch. Email us at podcast@theextrainch.co.uk. Subscribe, leave us a rating and a review. And most importantly, be sure to tell all of your Spurs friends. Shout out to the ex-subs, we love every single last one of you. And of course, come on you Spurs.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Did you know cats tend to hide symptoms of sickness and pain? I learned this the hard way after losing my cat, Gingy. So I created Pretty Litter, a health monitoring litter that helps detect early signs of illness by changing colors, saving you money and potentially your cat's life. Pretty Litter is veterinarian developed, and it's the easiest way to keep tabs on your fur baby's health right at home.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here, and it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. HelloFresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. HelloFresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.